Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, and welcome once again to History Dweebs. I am Tim. And welcome to our podcast today. The topic of our podcast today is the Mad Bomber, George Metesky, who terrorized New York City back in the 1950s over a period of 16 years by planting bombs around the city. And we'll talk about all his dastardly deeds. But first, let me introduce my colleague, the most dangerous man in podcasting today, the very honorable Colonel Charles Beauregard Hawk Waters III, affectionately known as Southern Gentleman. How are you today, Colonel?
Well, Timmy, I'm fine today, but you know, I'm doing this podcast under protest.
Why is that? Why are you protesting?
Well, we took a poll.
Yes.
And Rutabaga clearly won.
Okay.
He was heads and shoulders and paws above the other people.
Yeah. Well, let's explain a little bit for most of our listeners. We have two Facebook pages, right? We have the History Dweebs Facebook page, in which we post a lot of this day in history type of things and interesting stories, which is cool. And then we have another Facebook page called the History Dweebs Podcast page, and we encourage all of you to join that. But we got a cool group there. And so we were discussing some ideas on what topic we were going to cover today. So we put a poll out, and
Rutabaga won.
The topics that were posted, the winner of those that I posted was our topic today, which is the Mad Bomber. Now, somebody posted, threw another name into the, tossed another hat into the ring of your dog, Rutabaga.
They wanted to hear more about the dog.
Yeah, but see, he is not of any historical significance.
Rutabaga is the only dog in the west side of Cincinnati right now known to have killed a bear by himself.
Well, when you can get some documentation of that, you can bring
pictures.
It back. But until then, he did win, but you know, you were kind of screwing around with democracy there because you got your whole family involved, and you paid them to vote.
My family are members of the group, and they exercised their freedom and voted.
Yeah, well, I took it to the Rules Committee, namely me, and it was decided that we were not going to do a podcast on your dog. However, for those who really want to know about your dog, we'll dedicate the final 5 minutes of this podcast so you can talk all you want about Rudy for 5 minutes. But after we talk about the mad bomber. But before we do that, Colonel, do you have any shout-outs?
I do have a couple shout-outs, Timmy. We'd like to our good dear friend Charlie, and fellow podcaster. We'd like her to know that she is foremost in our thoughts.
Absolutely, absolutely, Charlie. We're thinking about you.
And Charlie is as I said another podcaster. She runs the Unblocked podcast.
That's a great podcast.
It is. If you haven't listened to it, you really ought to give it a shot. So many of the people that follow our page, they're just podcast people. There's two types of people, I think, in the world. There's podcast people, like my wife doesn't listen to podcasts.
Right.
Mrs. Colonel, she would not listen to one of our podcasts, Timmy.
Well, I can understand. I can understand that.
Yeah. I believe she's tired of hearing me.
But you know, interesting to say, because I was reading an article that you know, at least 50% of people listen to at least one podcast now.
No kidding.
Yeah. So it's the medium is starting to get into the mainstream now. But yeah, mostly just the cool people listen
mostly
to
the podcast. Cool people. Yeah. Now, Charlie, you know you're mean and mostly mean to me most of the time, but. But, you know, what thing about you? Now, the other one, we got a special shout-out.
A very special one. And you know, Timmy, we got one of our, on our podcast page that chimes in now and again, is Kim Taylor.
Yeah, it's Kim. Sure.
I ain't giving Kim a shout-out because she didn't vote for Rutabaga.
Kim likes history, though. She's really a history buff.
She does like history. She's from Beaver Lick, Kentucky. Which is an interesting...
Well, I think that's where she lives. I don't think she's from there.
Well, she lives Beaver Lick, Kentucky. She owns a pair of shoes, though. Has her own teeth, she claims. She posted a picture saying she had her own teeth. But she is not getting a shout-out today.
Okay. this is not a shout-out, Kim, if you're listening.
We are giving a shout-out to her little boy, Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Whose birthday is end of this month, last day of the month. And he occasionally listens to the not-so-bad parts of the podcast.
Oh, so she censors it?
Kim Taylor's son, Ryan.
Right. So she lets him listen to some of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay. Anyway, Ryan... We hope you have a good birthday. We hope that your mom and daddy get you what you deserve. If they don't, you let the colonel know. We'll dig into the History Dweebs Fund up here. We'll send you something down there.
Yeah, thanks for listening, Ryan.
Yeah, Ryan, be a good boy. And I know they got a son and a daughter, and she'll post some pictures and... very just adorable kids. She posted on Easter. She changed her profile picture. Little boy standing in front of a tree with his mama got a kilt on. They've got a very strong Scottish heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, always to Lady Beverly. Lady Beverly is just travels along with that British stiff upper lip to me. No matter what's going on with her, she's always always hanging in there. And I'm going to give you a shout out only because I've noticed one local person that we have that listens to us, that gets involved from time to time on the, page. And she posted a poo chart for you.
Yeah.
That's Tricia Hillard.
Yeah. Well, actually, we have a few local listeners, and John's a local listener.
Oh, John's a local one, too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Scott. But one thing I wanted to say about Kim Taylor is that her daughter made these really cool History Dweebs Easter eggs.
Caitlin.
Yes, and they were adorable. I think mine should have had a little bit more hair, but other than that, she got the devil, like, perfect.
She got the devil perfect. I had those horns sharpened up.
It's so nice to do a podcast without Brandy here. For those of you who are missing Brandy, we're sorry. She's taking a vacation week this week. Probably,
Is she drunk texting you right now?
Yeah, she's
drunk. Does that to me, too.
She gets drunk, man, early in the morning. I'm like 10
yeah,
in the morning.
She's, it's 1 she's, in the afternoon. She's, yeah, she's 3 south. Sheets to the wind,
yeah,
already.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's wrong with that girl. Got her kids. Yeah. She, you know what? She probably and the devil doesn't follow society's rules.
No.
She sent me a text. I know she's drunk. She's probably driving at the same time.
Probably.
You know,
probably
she
with her feet.
Probably. I don't know what's wrong with the woman. And I can't figure out why these other. You know why these other women like it, Tim?
I don't know why.
I don't know.
Oh,
I'm hoping
either.
You had an answer.
I don't have a clue.
I mean, Team Colonel got like two people on it. One's Rutabaga.
Yeah, Rutabaga and Scott. That's about it.
Rutabaga and Scott. But that's really all I need.
Yeah, I missed seeing Scott this weekend. I was hoping to catch up with him, but the timing didn't work out. But he was in Ohio this weekend.
Yeah, that's and I had the boys all in town. And was not able to get out, but we did get Scott we led him to Skyline Chili.
Yeah, and he said he's going to make another trip back in the summer, so hopefully we'll catch up with him. And I was working on Saturday and only had a little window where I could get with him, so I wasn't able to.
But that's all I can hit off the top of my head, Tim. I forgot to write my shout outs down, but I did want to get Ryan a happy birthday shout out, and the Caitlin, thank you for the eggs. And
yeah, that was really cool, Caitlin.
And Timmy, you got any over there?
Just my mom.
Oh, well, of course, I was saving Dottie for last.
Yeah, she's been feeling bad, but she's starting to feel better again. She can't get over this flu or whatever. It keeps coming back.
Is it a stomach virus that's going
around? No, I don't think. I think it's in congestion.
You know, bronchitis. We'll get on to that later, but Renee, I wish Renee get the laryngitis. That's what I'm trying to get Renee to get, the laryngitis.
And Brandy, too.
Oh, the devil immune to all that stuff.
I know. She's got all those, you know.
Unless you drive a stake through that woman's heart, ain't nothing going to happen.
She'll be back with us next. Well, maybe not next podcast, but next week, definitely. Okay. Just our regular shout outs. We thank you all for listening. And if you haven't joined the History Dweebs, the podcast Facebook group yet, please do so, because we got a cool group there and post all kind of cool stuff, and it's a nice little community. So love to have you.
It is a nice community. And Timmy, now I'm a little disappointed though, and I posted this on the podcast page. Do you got a stalker?
No.
Neither do I.
I know Brandy does.
I would have thought that after, you know, we have 5,000 followers, 5,000 likes, after all this,
yeah,
somebody stalked me.
I know.
I thought the price of payment fame would be somebody stalking the Colonel, and ain't nobody stalking the Colonel.
I know. We have to keep working hard to promote the show. We have this month will be over 10,000 downloads. So that's pretty good.
How out of all those people ain't nobody stalking?
I know. You would think there'd be someone out of 10,000 that would be interested in us, but apparently not. Okay, so if you haven't joined the History Dweebs, the podcast page, please do so. We'd love to have you. Let's get in. Let's talk about this nut job, Colonel George Metesky.
Yeah, I don't know that he was a nut job to me.
Well, in some ways I can relate to this guy because he was a disgruntled.
He was the first Occupy Wall Street guy.
Yeah, kinda. I think he had a case, but I don't know he went about it the right way. I don't want to get off topic too much, but the George Metesky became known as the Mad Bomber, and he was taking this action because he felt he was wrong. He was working for Con Ed, or Consolidated Edison, which is known, we'll refer to as Con Ed, utility company in New York City. And he was injured, and he was denied workman's compensation. He felt he was wrong, and he decided to express his outrage by planting bombs all over the city. So, up to the point you start planting bombs, I'm kind of on the guy's side.
Well, once you start blowing shit up, you're walking a fine line.
You really are. You're going
to
lose.
But you got to admit, there's some people need to be blown up. Some places, like the cable company, Timmy.
Yeah.
They tell you they're going to be there at 8 o'clock. It's 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Something needs to get blown up when you waited all day.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there. But he got a little carried away. But regardless, I can almost relate to him. On a personal note, my ex-spouse, who hopefully isn't listening because she'll get really upset, but she was injured on the job and kind of got screwed over the same way.
Mm-hmm.
She, it cost her a lot of money, and she suffered a lot of pain and stuff. And she decided to take a different path. She hasn't set bombs around the city, as far as I know. But
that's probably part of a problem too.
But I can see how someone would feel wrong, especially if you take someone who may be a little mentally unbalanced. And then,
which is about half the people I know,
right,
at least.
And then you have someone like Con Edison screw over them, or at least they feel that they were screwed over. You can see how something like this happens. But let's get back. Let's take a step back and let's talk about this guy.
And Timmy, just a real quick interlude here. I just got a note from our legal department.
Mm-hmm.
The Colonel in no way advocates blowing up of stuff.
Okay, good.
I simply stated that one could feel a certain amount of empathy for a person who does blow up stuff.
Yeah, especially when you get really screwed over. Like, apparently he did, but I think he either way, it was an overreaction, but...
some people do that, Tim.
Fortunately, you know, the people who were injured, no one was killed, but there were 15 people injured, you know, during his bombing, so they were certainly were innocent people, so it's hard to justify it, but...
He was kind of a piss-poor bomber, really. He came right down to it. Couldn't even kill a son-bitch.
Well, or maybe he wasn't trying to. So
you could kill somebody with an M-80.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, he... You know, let's get into the story. So we'll talk about it. So well before, there was Timothy McVeigh and the Unabomber. There was a quiet, unassuming man named George Metesky. And he terrorized New York City for more than 16 years, from 1940 to 1956. And he got the moniker, the Mad Bomber, by the New York media. And... he planted at least, that they know of, at least 33 bombs in New York City from 1940 to 1956. And although the bombs did not kill anyone, they did injure and maim 15 people. And probably more importantly, he just created an atmosphere of terror in New York City. He planted these bombs, explosive devices, in theaters and train stations and bus terminals and libraries. And in offices, especially the offices of Consolidated Edison, his former employer. The bombs were left in phone booths, storage lockers, restrooms in public buildings, Grand Central Station, Penn Station, Radio City Music Hall. I know you enjoy going to Radio City Music Hall.
I'd like to see a rocket now and again.
I thought you did. I had performed with the Rockettes. I thought I'd seen you on stage kicking your leg.
No, I actually choreographed the Rockettes
I see. The New York City Public Library, which, of course, is the most one of the most busy libraries in the country, if not the world. The Port Authority bus terminal, the RCA building, and in the New York City subway. So he planned these things all over the place. He also bombed movie theaters quite frequently. He didn't. A lot of times it was the Lowe's Theater. I'm not sure why. It's just the Lowe's Theater seemed to be one that he...
Because of some bitches, they were probably one of those places. You ever go to the movies and you ask for the extra butter on the popcorn? Yeah. Now, they're already charging you $11 for a bucket of popcorn.
But now you can do your own.
Yeah, sometimes, but still, I don't believe you always get the extra butter. Now, you don't get the extra butter, it's liable to get your theater blown up.
You know what I don't like? Is the new pop machines. Like, you know, it's one machine.
And then you press all the buttons?
Yeah.
See, I like those because I like to ask Renee, what is it you want, dear? And she'll just say something straight like Diet Pepsi. And I like to get a Diet Ginger Ale. I like to get like
Sherry flavors, vanilla.
Throw all kinds of stuff in there. And then she'll taste it and say, I hate these machines.
Now they have them in fast food restaurants. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, off topic. So anyway, in all, Metesky planted at least 33 bombs, of which 22 of those bombs exploded, injuring 15 people. So there were people hurt in this. So he's not, you know. And I think if people treat him kind of like a clown, a lot of it had to do with his effect when he was arrested. There's, you know, this famous picture of him in the jail cells just smiling, you know, just like. So he wrote letters to the police. He wrote letters to the newspapers. So he was kind of attention seeking throughout this whole ordeal. Again, that lasted 14 years, although most of his bombings were in waves, right? He had a long stretch when he didn't do any bombings at all. And then he would do, you know, six or seven in a year. So, but anyway.
I still don't get it. 33 bombs, but man, plus.
In New York City.
I could leave 33 banana peels in different parts of Cincinnati and kill at least two people.
Yeah, you would. I mean, you'd think that incidents, explosions, that's, you know, someone would die. But fortunately, no one did die, but 15 people were injured, as I said. So George Peter Metesky was born on November 2nd, 1903, in Waterbury, Connecticut. Now, I researched this guy because this guy, you know, we put this up in the poll, and this guy was ahead at the time I started to research. And there's just not a whole lot about his life. There's not a whole lot that's
known. There's a lot about his crimes, but not a lot about him.
Yeah, there's just not. He was just like this guy that just didn't have he kind of did not have much history that anyone was aware of. He was the youngest of three children who were born to his parents, who immigrated from Latvia. Isn't that where Andrew Kaufman's character was? Mm-hmm. On
Latvian?
On Taxi. So he had two older sisters. There's not, as I said, not much known of George's childhood other than he was a quiet and unassuming boy, a bit of a bookworm, so he was a little nerdy. He did well in school, but he didn't have a whole lot of friends. Now, there's no information about his relationship with his parents, so we don't know whether there was any indication of abuse or neglect or anything like that. Usually, like when we do these serial killers, we got all tons of, background information on them. But George, if it's there, I don't know where to find it. He was very close to his sisters. In fact, he ended up living with them as adults. Now, George never married, nor did his sisters. So, Yeah, I don't know what that...
Maybe there was a little hanky-panky going on in the family there,
yeah,
didn't
it? Or maybe they just were very,
There wasn't handsome people.
Close knit. Well, I don't know. I've never seen his sisters, but, he was...
Well, I seen him. They couldn't have been too good looking.
I don't know. So, but George never married, and there's no indication that he had any significant romantic relationships. Now, he may have, but it's just not documented. After graduating from high school in 1922, this is right after the First World War, McCaskey joined the U.S. Marines, and he served as a specialist electrician at the United States Consulate in Shanghai. So, he met some Chinese women over there, Got the web feet and all back in the 20s.
You think that would have put him in a better mood?
Yeah, Chinese women are beautiful. I don't know. Maybe he... but I don't know. We don't know what his love life was like. We're just speculating. But when he returned home, he went to work as a mechanic for a subsidiary of Consolidated Edison, and we will refer to henceforth as Con Ed, a utility company in the greater New York City area. And he lived in Waterbury, Connecticut, with his two unmarried sisters. So,
brother. Old maids.
Old maids. I had a friend who worked for Con Ed. No, I have a friend whose husband he still works for Con Ed, and he was working on 9/11.
Oh.
Can you imagine how much overtime he put in?
Oh, I bet that was...
I mean, he worked they worked a great deal. They had to work crazy hours. But anyway, in 1931... George was working on a generator, as a generator wiper. I don't know what that is. I guess they wipe off generators, I guess, at the company's Hell's Gate generating plant when a boiler backfired and produced a blast of hot gas.
Much like the devil does.
All the time.
Podcasting,
when we podcast. The blast knocked McCaskey down, and the fumes filled his lungs, choking him. Now, that accident left him disabled, and after collecting 26 weeks of sick pay, Con Ed fired him and let him go.
All those sons of bitches.
Didn't
have no workers' comp back then.
And no. Well, he did, but he was denied workman's comp. Now, what he claimed was that... And this was disputed by Con Ed, was that the accident led to him developing pneumonia, and that in turn developed into
the consumption.
Yeah, tuberculosis, which was, I guess, still around. Well, I mean, it's still around today, but it was still a little bit more prevalent in the 40s and 30s. So a claim of workman's comp was denied because he waited too long to file it, according to the report.
Poor bastard.
Yeah. I had one time when I was first married, we bought a house, our first house, and my wife was trying to put a washer on the faucet, and I said, "Now look," and I told her to get away, and I started screwing with it. I said, "The one thing we never do, the two things we never touch, is electricity and plumbing." And as soon as I let those words get out of my mouth, water shoots straight up in the air. I mean, it's hitting its ceiling, right? And, you know, the first thing I do, of course, is put my finger
put your finger in the dike, Timmy.
So we're scrambling. It's like on a holiday weekend. You know, I'm trying to turn off this water. We just moved in the house. I had no idea where where I could turn the water off. But anyway, I finally get a hold of this plumber, right? He worked for his company. And he said, well, you know, it's late at night. And, you know, I said, I got to have water, right? And I have to have water. It's a holiday weekend. He said, well, I'll come over and see what I can do. Now, he came over and he spent about 20 minutes and he charged me $500. And I told him, I said at the time, I said, you know what? I know you're screwing me. And he said, here's my card. If there's a problem, call me directly. Don't call the company.
Yeah.
So you know, I said, I know you're screwing me. But anyway, he had turned off the hot water heater. And he said, he's getting ready to leave. And he said, well, I can tell you what, I can light your hot water heater for you again if you like. So I said, yeah, sure, I'm paying you $500. Yeah. The least you can do.
Yeah, I'd like to have some hot water. That'd be nice.
Anyway, he went down and tried to turn on tried to light the pump, and that damn thing blew up in his face and knocked him back, singed his eyebrows.
See, you got your $500 worth.
Oh, my God. I was laughing so hard. He was okay. But it was like, yeah, bastard. That'll show you.
You know, I worked for a staffing company for years, Timmy. I was when I was doing some headhunting. And we had a gentleman that, it's a workers' comp story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got the two of them. This gentleman, he was a truck loader. He worked in the warehouse. Now, this is back when the cases of pop came on the wooden crates.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And in the summertime, they let you wear shorts in the warehouse because it was hot.
Hot, right.
And this gentleman decided to go commando.
Uh-oh.
This particular day.
Uh-oh.
And he lifted up a crate, and he stacked it on some other crates about four high, and he had to kind of just get on his tippy toes a little bit to get it up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he set it down. Well, he had some loose baggy shorts on, Timmy.
Uh-oh.
He caught Captain Tallywhacker between the wooden crates of cases of Pepsi as he set it down.
Ooh.
Now, this was quite uncomfortable.
I can imagine.
But what was one of the funniest things I've ever read was his workman's comp report. Because he apparently acquired a large hemoglobin on the tip of his penis.
We should be grateful.
Well, I believe the term is hematoma, but he put hemoglobin. But Timmy, to ask the man to fill out the form, it said,
did he have to draw a little photo, a little picture?
What action did you take? And the man said, I screamed.
I can understand that. I can understand
that. And we had one dumb son of a bitch. He broke his back sweeping the dock backwards.
He was walking backwards and fell off a
12-foot dock.
Yeah.
And broke his back. Now, for those, you shouldn't even have to pay workers.
Right, right.
That's just Darwinism coming into play.
Yeah, that's just stupid.
But when I read the report, it said what action. What they mean was, you know, did you ice it? What action was taken? He just put down, I screamed.
That's, you know.
It's the only reasonable action you could take.
Yeah, for the first 5 minutes, anyway. Yeah.
He had a huge hemoglobin.
Yeah, well, poor George. He appealed his denial for workman's comp three times, and it was also rejected all three times. The last one was in 1936. So George developed a hatred for the company's attorneys and also for some of his coworkers who he felt perjured themselves in the compensation case. You know, he was a disgruntled former employee, right?
Yeah.
He felt he'd been wrong, and the company screwed him over. But so the weird thing is, this happened in 1936. His appeals ran out in 1936. The first bomb that he detonates or tries to detonate is in 1940. So he waited 4 years before, you know, I guess he's seeming with anger over the situation. On November 16, 1940, he left a bomb, a homemade bomb, on a windowsill at Con Ed's power plant in Manhattan. It was a crude, the first bomb was crude, short-length brass pipe filled with gunpowder and enclosed in a wooden box. And he left it on the windowsill, and it was found before it could go off. It was wrapped in a note, block letters. It was like, you know, some of his notes were like out of the old crime stories where they cut out things from the magazine.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
I leave those at home sometimes.
But some of them were handwritten. And all of his, in this first letter just said, Con Edison Crooks, this one is for you. And it was signed FP. So all his letters were signed FP, and we'll get in. You'll talk about what that means later. So some of the investigators of this first bomb, they thought maybe it was an intentional dud because had it exploded, the note would have exploded.
That's true.
it would have been no sense leaving
a note. Kind of pointless to leave a note that's going to blow up, burn up.
Exactly. So that was the first bomb. The second bomb occurred on September 6, 1941. It was very similar. It was found lying on the street about five blocks away from Con Ed's headquarters in Manhattan. This one had no note, and it was also a dud. Now, police theorized that the bomber may have spotted a cop and dropped the bomb before setting its fuse. Now, that's September 1941. Of course, on December 7, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, U.S. military installation in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and then it's the beginning of World War II. Shortly after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the police received a letter from George. It stated, "I will make no bomb units for the duration of the war. My patriotic feelings have made me decide this. Later, I will bring Con Edison to justice. They will pay for their dastardly deeds." Signed, FP.
So he sounds like a great American to me, Timmy.
He does. He even wears dastardly deeds, mm-hmm. So he's very well spoken.
Yeah. Dastardly deeds.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I keep picturing Boris and Natasha, you know, little Boris yeah. with a little bomb, and he lights it and runs away.
Yeah, the round
black bomb. Yeah, little round black bomb.
So being a man of his word, George planted no bombs between 1941 and 1951, so 10 years.
Oh, that's a long time.
Yeah, and the weird thing is, you know, the war only lasted until 1945, so he gave him a little extra time.
He was a planner. He was a planner, Timmy.
I mean, you know, he's walking around with all this anger it had to be just miserable. But during that time—
Well, look at the devil. She walked around with anger every day.
Well, that's true. She has anger issues. That's mm-hmm. correct. Now, instead of sending bombs, though, he would send a lot of crank letters and postcards to police stations, to newspapers, to private citizens, and to Con Edison. So,
was he sending a postcard like, is your refrigerator running or something like that?
I don't know. But he would always sign him FP, and he would always be, talking about the anger he felt toward Con Edison, his former employer. Now, investigators started studying these messages, and they were penciled. The ones that didn't, you know, were not the cutouts, were in block letters. And the W was a little weird, the G's were a little weird, and the Y's were a little odd shape. So they thought by that he may have had a European education. So that was one of the early theories, that he was European. Now, George did not return to actual bombing, until 1951. That was 10 years after his last bomb, that the one he found on the street a few blocks from Con Ed headquarters that didn't explode. But on March 29, 1951, he planted his third bomb. This one was a little bit more sophisticated than the earlier bombs. And it was also the first bomb to actually explode. The explosion startled commuters in Grand Central Terminal, but it didn't injure anyone. If you've ever been in Grand Central Station...
Never have been.
It is crazy busy, as you can imagine. It's like Grand Central Station, right?
Yeah.
Lots and lots of people, so it's a miracle. A bomb went off there. It did not hurt anyone. It's just really miraculous. He had dropped it in a sand urn near the oyster bar in the terminal's lower level, but no one was hurt on that attempt.
He's kind of a piss poor bomber so far.
Well, so far he only had one to go off.
Now, striking fear in the hearts of people.
Now, the police believe the long hiatus since the second bomb and the third one, but the whole time between them, and the improved construction techniques of the first new bomb, this latest bomb, led investigators to believe that the bomber had served in the military, so he kind of knew what he was doing. In April 1951, McKessie's next bomb exploded, again without injury, and it was in a phone booth in the New York Public Library. In August, a few months later, in August 1951, a phone booth bomb exploded with no injuries at Grand Central Station. So, you know, people were scared to use the phone in the early 1950s in New York. George next planned a bomb that exploded without injury in another phone booth at the Con Ed headquarters. So, I mean, early on, they should have a pretty good idea. This guy had something against Con Ed. I mean, I'm not sure why it took so long to figure this out. Right. He also mailed a bomb. So he actually mailed a bomb, like the Unabomber, which did not explode to Con Ed's headquarters in Con Ed's headquarters in White Plains, New York. So, and he's mailing bombs now. But on October 22nd, 1951, just a few weeks before my oldest brother's birthday, he was born, the New York Herald Tribune received a letter in penciled block letters stating, and I quote, "Bombs will continue until the Consolidated Edison Company is brought to justice for their dastardly deeds against me. I have exhausted all other means. I intend with bombs to cause others to cry out for justice for me." Unquote.
He likes that dastardly deeds.
He does. He does. The letter directed police, also directed the police to Paramount Theater in Times Square, where a bomb was discovered, and they disabled it. They also directed them to a telephone booth in Penn Station, and nothing was found. So he's giving them a runaround a little bit. He's messing with them. Now, on November 28, 1951, which is 1 month later, a coin-operated locker at the 14th Street subway station was bombed. It went off again without injury. So, you know, about five or six bombs into this thing, he hasn't hurt anyone yet. In late December of 1951, right before Christmas, the Herald Tribune, New York Herald Tribune, received another letter warning from George. It said, and I quote, "Have you noticed the bombs in your city? If you're worried..." Yes, kind of hard not to. "If you're worried, I am sorry. And also, if anyone is injured, but it cannot be helped, for justice will be served.
For the dastardly deeds?
I am not well. And for this, I will make Con Edison sorry. Yes, they will regret their dastardly deeds. I will bring them before the bar of justice. Public opinion will condemn them. For beware. I will place more units under theater seats in the near future." Signed, FP.
He said units.
Yeah, he did. He did indeed say unit. So, okay, so that's near Christmas, right? So in March 19th, 1952, so he took a few months off, or enjoyed the holidays.
Oh, yeah, you got it. Yeah.
Probably watched football playoffs and all that. But
well, March Madness.
Yeah, March Madness. So March 19th, 1952, bomb exploded in a phone booth at the Port Authority bus terminal, again, without causing any injuries. You got to think maybe he was, you know, I wonder if he was, like, intentionally trying not to hurt anyone. I think later on he gets a little bit crazier, but I think early on he maybe was just trying to get attention. In June, and again in December of 1952, bombs exploded in the seats at the Lexington Avenue Lowe's Theater. You know, I didn't know Lowe's Theater had been around that long, but I guess they have been. Now, in the December bombing, December of 1952, it actually injured someone. This was the first time.
It's about time. If you got any self-respecting bomber would three bombs, you'd think you'd need to hurt somebody.
Anyway, this is the first time it actually hurt somebody. The person survived. Now, police at that point asked the newspapers not to print any more of the bomber's letter and tried to play down the earlier bombers because they thought he was just seeking attention. But the public became aware that the mad bomber as he became known, was on the loose. So, in 1953, bombs exploded in the seats at the Radio City Music Hall and at the Capitol Theater, again these with no injuries. A bomb again exploded near the Oyster Bar in Grand Central's terminal. Man, he must have had something.
He didn't like oysters either.
That's not
it. He didn't like oysters and dances.
It's the second time he hit that place. This time it was in a coin-operated rental locker. Again, there was no injuries. Now, an unexploded bomb was found. This is 1953. He was on a roll in 1953. An unexploded bomb was found in a rental locker at Penn Station. Penn Station being very much like Grand Central Station. It's just crazy busy. 1954, a bomb wedged between a sink and the Grand Central Station, Grand Central Terminal men's room exploded, slightly injuring three men. So now he's bombing men's rooms. Would lead me to think it was a man at this point.
Mm-hmm.
A bomb was planted in a phone booth at the Port Authority bus terminal, exploded with no injuries. On November 7th, 1954 now. On November 7th, 1954, it was Christmas time, and there was a capacity crowd at the Radio City Music Hall. They were 6,200 people to watch Bing Crosby's White Christmas. So it's it's a holiday season. New York City's
all happy. Everyone the packages
got their Christmas gifts. You're right. They got they're all in the holiday spirit. The city is decorated. I mean, it's a cool time to be in the city. So on November 5th, they had this showing of Bing Crosby's White Christmas at the Radio City Music Hall. 6,200 people, and a bomb stuffed in the bottom cushion of a seat in the 15th row exploded. And this time it seriously injured four people in the audience.
Now, how in the hell you got, I'm just going to say this. He was a piss poor bomb maker.
Well, or he wasn't trying to hurt anyone.
How'd you like to be sitting there enjoying the show and have your ass blow up, Timmy?
I would not like that. I would not like that. I would like to watch the end of, especially Bing Crosby, because I'm a big Crosby fan.
I'm dreaming.
Right. I would like to. This is a good movie. I would like to watch it, but I would not like to be injured. You're right. But the explosion was muffled by someone's fat ass. No, I'm kidding. The explosion was muffled by heavy upholstery in those seats. Remember the old movie theater seats? Those things were heavily
upholstered. Now they got recliners and everything.
Yeah, I know. Back in the old days, man, those things were. But the seats were these. Oh. Anyway, so there's a lot of people never even heard it, The film continued. The film continued, and the injured would have escorted down. I would have got a clue when people, the attendants were pulling people out on stretchers. I would probably got a clue that something's wrong.
You know that poor sumbitch had one of those hemorrhoid donut rings he had to sit on.
Probably so. So they were, the injured was escorted to the first aid room, and about 50 people in the immediate area were moved to the back of the theater, and that was that. After the film, the following stage show concluded an hour and a half later. The police roped off 150 seats in the area where the explosion took place. So that was all. I mean, the show must go on, I guess.
Now, when they blump, do you think, there was some asshole?
I mean, at that point, you think he must be actually trying to hurt people.
you know, some asshole in the theater is shushing him when the bomb goes off.
Probably so. Probably so. Wouldn't it be, you're sitting in front of somebody and all of a sudden they're blown out of their seat?
Or you're sitting in front of them and they get blown over the top of
you. Yeah, you said throw popcorn at them.
That didn't make Christmas worth it almost.
Well, yeah, something to remember. But going back to this, remember the police asked the newspapers to stop printing his letters.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, that might have motivated him to
get more aggressive.
Yeah, to get more aggressive in it and to pick a larger target. So in February of 1955, a bomb exploded without injuries on the platform of the Sutter Avenue subway station in Brooklyn. In April of 1955, 2 months later, a bomb was found beneath a phone booth, or I'm sorry, a bomb beneath a phone booth exploded at the main floor of Macy's department store with no injuries. In June of 1955, two bombs exploded without injuries at Penn Station, one in a rental locker and one in a phone booth. Man, I'm not using the phone booth in Penn Station.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're going to the Oyster Bar. In July of 1955, 1 month later, a bomb was found at Radio City Music Hall. After a warning phone call, so someone called and said there's a bomb. And also in July, same month, at the Roxy Theater, a bomb dropped out of a slash seat out of the upholstery's workbench without exploding. The thing he would do, he would go in these theaters and he would cut a hole in the upholstery and he'd put the bomb in
under
it. Yeah. And you know, those seats were really thick. Mm-hmm. Those old theater seats.
And these were mostly pipe bombs that he was making.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in August of 1955, a bomb exploded at the Paramount Theater in Manhattan. One patron was struck in the foot by fragments and was injured. Investigators discovered a small penknife pushed aside inside one of the seats, one of several found at the seats. In the theater seats after this bombing. So he went around the different seats and I guess trying to figure out where he was going to put this bomb and cut holes in it. They found his knife. They theorized that the bomber had left knives behind in case he was stopped and questioned. I don't know what that means. In December of 1955, a bomb exploded at the Grand Central Station, men's room in a urinal. Yeah, so that would not have been good to be in there taking a leak when that thing went on. No one was injured, fortunately. So that brings us up to 1956. In February of 1956, a 74-year-old men's room attendant. Now, first of all, man, I hope if I'm 74 years old, I'm not working. And if I am working, I hope I'm not a men's room attendant. Because... Yeah, that's not something I want to do.
They didn't have retirement back then.
I guess they had Social Security.
They had Social Security.
Yeah, but, you know.
He was just a go-getter, Timmy.
Expensive to live in New York, I guess. Anyway, a 74-year-old year old men's room attendant at Penn Station. God, what a job. How nasty is that, man? It's not like people are coming in there leaving you tips. You got the homeless coming in there and peeing on the floor and stuff. Yeah. Taking a dump on the floor.
Using your towels as blankets.
Yeah. Anyway, he was injured when the bomb in the toilet bowl exploded.
See, now, raising three boys, I have had my toilet bomb before, Timmy.
Yes, see, it's something you're used to.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant thing.
A young man had reported... What happened? A young man went to the men's room attendant and he reported an obstruction in the toilet. And the attendant tried to clear it out with a plunger. Which, you know, that's a reasonable thing to do.
You know what? And it's that moment that the whole thing clears up that you think victory.
Yeah.
And then it blows up.
Yeah. He was hit with some porcelain fragments.
And I'd assume some fecal fragments.
I didn't say, but investigators found a watch frame and a wool sock. So, now, we don't know if that was to the, you know, belonged to the bomber or just some random guy putting his sock down the toilet. But
washing his socks.
In March, a guard at the RCA building, and this is a bright move, a guard at the RCA building in Rockefeller Center discovered a piece of pipe about 5 inches long in a telephone booth. A second guard thought it might be useful in a plumbing project he had at home, and he took it home on a bus to New Jersey, where it exploded on his kitchen table the next morning. No one was injured, though. I was thinking that thing went off on the bus.
Nothing's free, Timmy. Nothing's free.
On December 2nd, 1956, a small group of New Yorkers looking to forget their pre-holiday worries filed into the Paramount Movie Theater in Brooklyn. This is almost like, you know, that what happened the year before at the... that at the showing of Bing Crosby's Right Christmas at Rockefeller Center, some moviegoers were weighted down with Christmas packages, as we talked about. You know, they were out shopping. They decided to take in a movie for a couple hours, escape their cares. And at 5:55 p.m., a bomb ripped apart the theater. When the smoke and panic cleared, six people were injured. Three of those injuries were serious. And the bomber himself would write, it would by the hand of God that nobody was killed. Everyone knew who to blame for the attack. It was, of course, the Mad Bomber, or as he is known by his signature, F.P. The next day, the police commissioner, Stephen P. Kennedy, ordered what he called the greatest manhunt in the history of the police department, New York Police Department, to capture the Mad Bomber.
Well, and here's where he had some problems, Timmy.
All right.
The bomber was his... Now, you might say his competence. His competence here, Timmy. It made tracing his devices nearly impossible. He was using basic stuff.
Yeah, stuff you would anyone just, would yeah, just, access to.
And I guess he would go to different hardware stores and whatnot. And mm-hmm. Just buying the watches, you'd think. But, you know. Anyway. He is a traditional police worker. It had gotten him no leads anywhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, you know, this is a long, we're talking 16 years here now.
Yeah.
Like we said, he had a long period, 10 years, where he was not even active other than sending letters. But, you know, 16 years this guy was on the loose.
So they want to know why, you know, what's supposed to be the greatest police force in the world is coming up with none. Now, since traditional means had not gotten him anywhere, mm-hmm. This Inspector Howard Finney, he's from the crime lab in New York City. He decided it was time to try something new, Timmy.
Yeah, he was a little progressive. He was like an old-time cop, but he was open to new ideas.
He was. So he and his friend Captain Cronin at the Missing Persons Bureau, he asked him if he had any ideas. Now, Cronin suggested a Ouija board. So these
couldn't hurt.
Yeah, these two get on a Ouija board. They fool around for about 2 days.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Okay, well, it could have happened.
It could have happened.
Could have happened.
But it didn't.
Okay, that's a possibility.
Yeah.
But that didn't pan out. So Cronin suggested possibly a psychiatrist could work up a profile of Obama, and that profile could be useful in catching him. Now, a milestone marker in the history of crime and catching criminals.
Yeah, because they had it around. Profiling was around then, but it was not really widely used. And it had been used on this is probably the most prominent case it had ever been used on up to this point.
Yeah, I mean, police had always been kind of profiling, but mm-hmm. the idea of taking your clues and saying, this is what the guy's going to be when you find him.
Right.
And this is who you should look for.
It was a new approach.
It was a new approach. So, Finney was a tough, respected guy, and he had the clout to try this crazy idea.
Yeah, because I said, he was kind of an old school cop.
Well, but he also had a master's degree in forensic criminology.
Right, but I mean, he had the respect of his superiors to try something new because he developed this reputation as, you know, he had credibility.
Yeah, so he didn't. He was able to give this concept a try. Now he has this huge case file under his arms, and Finney and two of his detectives paid a visit to Cronin's friend. This Manhattan criminal psychiatrist named James Brussel. Finney had no idea how this was going to turn out. Okay.
I mean, at this point, they're out of options, really. They don't, you know, unless he screws up and someone sees him, they don't know what, you know, they're not going to find him, right?
Right. Now, this Brussels is a pretty smart guy. He's your typical psychiatrist smoking a pipe.
Did he have the patches on his...
He did. He had the elbow patches and everything else. Mm-hmm. Now, he had been thinking about this Mad Bomber case on his own, but, you know, like most New Yorkers. But he didn't have a case file. You know, he just kind of had his own theories.
Right.
So he hadn't come up without anything. You know, it did pop in and out of his head. Now, that all changed when Finney came to his office with a case file. Brussels agreed to meet with the inspector as a favor. And now, since he was primarily in private practice, Brussels also served as the assistant commissioner of mental hygiene for the state of New York. Mental hygiene.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's good to have a clean mind.
It's yeah, it's like the devil.
She needs
mental hygiene. She gets those not so fresh feeling days.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it permeates to her mind.
She gets the she needs a
she needs mental hygiene.
She needs them. Yeah, she needs Massengale run through her ears to try to clean
out
her
brain.
But anyway, Timmy, he had gone to conferences for the state of New York in that position, and he met Captain Cronin, and he'd impressed Captain Cronin. And this guy later on wrote a memoir, The Case of a Crime Psychiatrist, and he admitted that he doubted he could be useful to this case at all. He was very confident that his profession had its own abilities, but he did not believe that he could add anything that professional detectives had not already discovered.
He didn't think he could foretell the future.
Right. Turns out his self-confidence was wrong, misplaced. Now, prior to practice, Brussels had served in the military as the chief of neuropsychiatry at Fort Dix during World War II.
Hey, he's at Dix.
Fort Dix.
Yeah.
And then you should have a fort for Dix.
Yeah. I mean, that's where Klinger was stationed at in MASH.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, before he went to Korea.
And then he was at, the head of Army neuropsychiatry for the entire Army during the Korean War. And during that time, he'd done counterintelligence profile work for the FBI and CID.
Okay, so he was...
His credentials were pretty solid.
Right.
Now, he also admitted this Captain Finney kind of intimidated him. He believed old cop wouldn't settle for anything but solid conclusions and would dismiss the psychiatric profession entirely if he proved wrong. Now, from the amused
glances... But, I mean, you give it to Finney. I mean, at least he was open to trying it. You know, but I think, like you said...
But Brussels figured these guys... He thought these guys had already dismissed him. So he thought, you know, he felt a lot of pressure... And he studied and studied this case file, and he came up with a profile. And the main conclusion, the bomber was most certainly mad. He was batshit crazy.
That was a good call there.
Yeah. Now, you could. Now, I don't have 38 degrees, Timmy, but a guy that keeps blowing up the oyster bar and phone booths and whatever, I'm going to tell you, he's a little bit crazy.
Yeah, he's a little unhinged. And I could probably tell you he probably at some point worked for Con Ed or at least had his electric cut off.
He's had some kind of bad experience with Con Ed. Bad interaction with Con Ed.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, I'm not an expert, but that's what I'd be looking at.
Yeah, I think that should be our next job is criminal profiles.
I think we would do
one. Because when you see stuff on the news, a lot of times, do you think, that sounds like some Brandy do?
You know, or Ally down in Australia. Every time I see
Every time you hear anytime I hear of a serial killer south of the equator.
Yeah, I think
of Ally.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's a nice enough lady.
Yeah, for a serial killer. She's cool.
Even for a normal person. Yeah. Except for the fact that she, you know, got bodies buried in the basement and whatnot. Now, anyway.
Now, Celine, I see more of her as a spree killer.
I see Celine as a spree killer.
Yeah.
She's like a Lizzie Borden.
Type. Yeah, she'll just go off and take out half a city block someday.
Right. Yeah. She'd go down to, and her book ain't at the bookstore, they're out of it. And she's like, what?
She'll go downtown Detroit and open up. Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know what? Do a lot of our listeners scare you a little bit?
A lot, actually.
And we love you.
Yeah, we love you, but you're crazy.
But you're kind of crazy. So anyway, now he has an important.
So we're kind of profiling our listeners.
All right. They came up. He comes up with a profile. He studies this file forever. He comes up with a profile.
And his profile is pretty good.
Yeah. Came up to the following conclusions. Obama was a male because, with few exceptions, historically, Obamas are always male.
Well, and also he bombed a men's room a couple of times.
Yeah, women that have a hard time running in and out of men's rooms.
Yeah.
So here's another. Now this one was a brilliant work.
Unless you're in North Carolina, then
yeah, you can't.
There's some problems.
In a brilliant move of detectivery, mm-hmm. Timmy. They came up to the conclusion that he had a grudge against Con Edison and was likely a former employee.
Some real insight there.
He believed himself to have been permanently injured by the company and was seeking revenge. This conclusion was obvious from the letters.
Mm-hmm.
The bomber was a textbook paranoid. He believed that Con Edison and the public at large conspired against him.
Well, he's probably right about Con Ed.
Yeah, well, the public at large, once he started blowing people's asses off in the seats, they was conspiring against him, too.
Right.
Now, Obama was middle-aged, probably around 50, because paranoia generally peaks at around age 35, and Obama had been active for 16 years.
Yeah, mine's not peaked yet, but...
No, but mine's getting there. Mm-hmm. Mine's getting there. Obama was neat, meticulous, and skilled at his work. Everything from carefully constructed bombs to the neat lettering to the careful planning of the bombs indicated his neatness. Also, paranoids tend to set high standards. That's set high standards for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So as not to open themselves to unwanted criticism. And paranoids hate criticism.
Yeah.
And have you ever noticed that, like, we three do a podcast together,
right. Mm-hmm.
And just the tiniest little thing to her.
To Brandy.
She's like, yeah, remember when she stabbed me with the letter opener in the hand?
Very sensitive.
And that was just because I said, you're not far, close enough to the microphone.
Yeah.
And she stabbed me with
very sensitive to criticism.
Oh, yeah.
That's for sure.
She's
but, you
insecure.
Know, and folks with paranoia are hard to treat, too, because... They don't trust you. You know what I mean?
Well, actually, they say the most mental illness, the most dangerous of the mentally ill. Mentally ill people typically are not that dangerous.
Right.
Until you get to the paranoid schizophrenics.
Yeah.
That's when you get to anybody with a paranoid because they believe that they're striking first to ward off. Everything they do is acting as self-defense because
right.
they believe people are out
and
to
it's
get
not
them.
To say that. People who are paranoid schizophrenic are all
violent. Not at all. But those
who are violent tend to be
yeah. And it's kind of like saying
and like I said, they're hard to treat because you have to build trust and
right.
and you just can't. It's difficult. It's really hard to build trust with someone who is has paranoia.
And, this just got me to speaking of paranoia, because, I was on the campaign trail, and one of the most paranoid guys I ever seen in my life, and, I mean, he was paranoid, crazy paranoid.
Who was that?
Ted Cruz.
Yeah?
Ted Cruz. Timmy, you believe he slept with five women?
I don't know, dude. I don't know what to think of that whole thing, Part of me thinks that there's where smoke, there's fire, but then I can't imagine five women wanting... Well, we know he swallows.
Yeah.
We've seen that on the debate.
But that just popped into my head with paranoia because he was paranoid all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's always looking over his shoulder, watching his eyes shift all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know about the five women. How you gonna fight five women? Colonel can't even get
Trump's
a stalker
a bit
from
paranoid
here.
Too, I think.
Well, I think when you get to that level, they're all paranoid.
Yeah, probably
me,
so. Because there's a lot of people out to get you.
A lot of people really out to get you.
I had a psych professor who used to say, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean
they ain't out to get you.
Exactly.
That's right. But, so these people are paranoid, and a colonel can't even get a stalker. And how in the world did you
not do well in this election cycle? That's what I want to know.
Well, you know what? It was because I got tired of traveling around, and plus they kept putting me on the same bus with Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
And he talks incessantly to me.
Yeah.
And so I got tired of it, and I said, hey, you know what? If I'd hung in there, the choice would be right now, me, Ted Cruz, or Donald Trump for the Republicans.
I think you would.
Or me, Hillary, or Bernie for the Democrats.
Yeah.
How could I lose?
I don't think you could.
I mean, pick one that's better than me, Tim.
I think I'd vote for you.
I think anybody with the right mind would vote for me. You got, we'll get back into that.
Okay.
So here, the bomber was foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Well, spent a majority of his time with foreign people, much like you do, Timmy.
When I can.
When you can. The bomber wrote in stilted, formal language bereft of any contemporary slang. He utilized phrases like dastardly deeds.
See, now, next time some bomber uses dastardly deeds, because this damn podcast are going to come after me.
Yeah.
So what are you saying there? That I'm, what did they say about his use of language?
He utilized, it was bereft of any contemporary slang.
Is that me?
That's like, you know how I come in the morning and I say, yo, dog, what up, G?
Yeah.
That's contemporary slang.
Oh, yeah, that's not
okay.
Me.
Yeah, you gotta get more with the times.
I'm sorry.
And he referred to Con Edison as the Con Edison. Mm-hmm. When New Yorkers had referred to the utility giant without the V for years.
Yeah, it's known as Con Ed, generally.
Yeah. So the continuation of the profile here, Obama had at least a high school education, Timmy, but probably no college.
Mm-hmm.
The stilted language of the letters and skilled construction of the bomb spoke of self-education. The excellent handwriting indicated at least some formal schooling.
Okay.
The bomber was a chronic masturbator.
Did not say that. Okay. But living with your sisters.
I was just seeing if the listeners were paying attention.
Yeah, they probably wasn't.
Okay.
Living with your two unmarried sisters.
There's probably
a lot of masturbation going on in that.
I would think so. Yeah, well, because here's another one. He was probably a Slav and Roman Catholic.
Okay.
Culturally speaking, Eastern and Central Europeans most often employ bombs as weapons. And most Slavs are Catholic.
Yeah, I wonder if they're, from that stereotype, if they're going back to, like, the anarchist movement, early 19th century.
Which was popular.
And it was all Eastern Europeans.
And they blew it out. They had all kinds of bad bombs.
There was, they had bombs on, bombs went from Wall Street and in Chicago. But anyway, back to George.
So the bomber lived in Connecticut, not New York. Some of the letters had been mailed from Westchester County. And
it's just right outside the city.
Yeah, that's between Connecticut and New York. And mm-hmm. Connecticut was home to a large community of Eastern and Central Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of following logic. The bomber suffered from, I never pronounced this word, Timmy, Oedipus complex.
Mm-hmm.
Like most sufferers, he was likely unmarried and lived with a single female relative or relatives that were not his mother.
So he is theorizing there was some kind of problem with his relationship with his mother. He was in love with his mother, basically.
Lost his mother young,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Russell made these conclusions based on the phallic construction of the bombs. They were built like penises, Timmy. The bombs. See.
Are you making this up?
No, it's right here in your words. And here's the difference.
Must have been asleep when I was.
The bombs were like penises.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the colonel,
spreading his seed.
As opposed to the colonel, whose penis is the bomb to me.
I see.
Or at least it was I've been told.
Okay.
Somehow we got through this whole thing, almost through this whole thing with a guy getting on tallywhackers.
Yeah, not mentioning, we haven't talked much about penises today.
Yeah, but he had a phallic construction to the bomb.
One of our listeners sent us a critique of the show, and she was very sweet. She was trying to give us, some real guidelines on how to make the show better. And one of her suggestions, she talked about the echoing and the sound and all that, but one of her suggestions is to cut out the penis jokes. And I'm like, what are we going to talk about? That's our whole, that's the show.
Does she not understand it with 13-year-old boys?
I don't know. Like,
yeah, well, penises are always funny.
Yes.
You,
some funnier than others.
Some are funnier than others, yeah.
Rasputin's was funnier than others.
Oh, yeah, when they chopped it off, put it in a jar, pickled it. But anyway, the strange and breast-like W's in Obama's otherwise perfect handwriting and the strange slashing and penetration of the movie seats.
So this guy was Freudian, it sounds like.
Yeah. As far as Finney and the detectives were concerned, these were his most far-fetched and dubious conclusion. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Brussell was very confident in these.
Mm-hmm.
So now here's where the game begins, Timmy.
Okay.
Finney and his detectives were impressed, despite the doubts. Now, they had drawn some of Dr. Brussell's conclusions themselves through traditional detecting.
He had a beef against Con Ed.
Yeah, that was pretty obvious.
Yeah, the letters kind of give that away.
Yeah, and as Brussell developed this profile, he became more and more confident in his conclusions, and that confidence became kind of infectious. And once they had the profile, Brussell said, you know, what we should do with it, there's probably hundreds of men who fit this, but only one bomber. And Brussell said, you know, I think you ought to give it to the newspaper and the radio and publicize it.
Yeah, because remember, they had told the newspapers not to publish this. This guy was just seeking attention. But now they're coming up with strategy. They're going to have to draw him out, right?
Yeah. So now Finney, he wasn't big on this idea. But Brussell said, you know, I think there's a chance he'll come forward by himself if we handle him right. I think he wants to be found out. Now, Brussell continued to argue with the detectives that the bomber wanted publicity and wanted credit for his work. He was outraged by the newspapers not publishing his letters, much like I get when they don't put my letters to the editor in there.
Right.
You know?
I wrote a letter to the editor one time because, you know, you do an email now. And mm-hmm. I don't know what it was. It was something stupid. It's about the Reds or something. You know, they printed the damn thing. And it was embarrassing as hell because I didn't really think they printed it because, you know, I figured they get thousands of them. And they actually printed it. It was, you know, something on sports. It wasn't even really important. But, I never read the newspaper. So people were like, you know, calling me up. Hey, I saw your letter.
Well, I'm reading the letters to the editor one day and I see this one. It's, you know, the free store.
Mm-hmm.
Or not the free store, I'm sorry, the drop-in center. It's a men's homeless shelter. They were building a cover for a smoking area because it's illegal to smoke indoors in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So they were building this smoking shelter, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It cost about $300,000 to build this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this letter to the editor saying how they should not be building this thing because these people... And it gives this list of reasons, and illogical reasons. And I thought, you heartless son of a bitch. The homeless, let them go out and smoke a cigarette once in a while. If they,
right.
What the hell's wrong with you? And it's saying, well, these are people who clearly do not have a lot of disposable income.
So they shouldn't be
smoking. So they should not be spending their money on cigarettes. Smoking causes health issues. They probably are not healthy, living the healthiest of lifestyles. The smoking is only hurting them more. So
it's
you should
easy
not
to be judgmental,
spending,
I guess, when you're, you know,
yeah.
When you have access to.
So I was about to fire
shelter.
Off a response to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at it and it says, T. Walters Westwood. It was my son, Tanner, and he was 11 years old. Now, the policy for the Inquirer was that you had to be 13 to publish a letter. He lied and sent the letter in there. And I get back to him, and I was like, what the hell's wrong with you? Let the homeless people have a damn cigarette, would you? He's like, Dad, it's not good for him. And that's when I smoked myself. And he's like, and you should quit smoking, too. I was like, you know what? You should just shut the hell up.
Well, he's a true West Sider.
He is. So anyway, so where was I at? So he was outraged that they're not publishing his letter, and he would be further outraged at the idea some clever psychiatrist found him out. So Dr. Brussell predicted that if in fact anything was wrong with the profile, the bomber would not be able to resist telling the police. And he'd have to go to the media and say that this psychiatrist, Mr. Smarty Pants, was not as smart as he thought. Mm-hmm. So even if the profile was on target, the bomber might be goaded into revealing details that could lead the police to him. Now, Dr. Brussell won the argument despite the fact that Finney believed that the plan would be bring in a million crackpots. Now, as Finney and his detectives left the office, Brussell couldn't resist making one more conclusion about the bomber. A neat, conservative man, he would be wearing the safest and most conservative clothes of the day in the neatest possible way. One more thing, Dr. Brussell said. Now, I couldn't resist making this conclusion. When you catch him, and I have no doubt that you will, he will be wearing a double-breasted suit.
Oh.
And after a shocked exclamation from the detectives, he continued, and it will be buttoned.
You have to be cautious when you're buying a double-breasted suit.
Yeah, you got to make sure you got two breasts.
Well, that's, you get a mastectomy and it's, you know, you have to throw it away.
It's over.
Yeah.
Now, all the major newspapers, including the Times, published these summaries. Now, police, as Finney predicted, all these crackpots came forward. Additionally, plenty of normal civic-minded citizens brought leads to the police.
Mm-hmm.
Each one had a friend or neighbor that fit that profile, and suddenly, you know, they were convinced that this guy's my next-door neighbor's a guy blowing up the place.
Yeah. Well, you would think the Con Ed thing would narrow it down a bit.
Well, a Darien, Connecticut commuter told the police about a neighbor who had once worked for Con Edison, who had spent some time in mental hospitals for paranoia. This guy was a skilled mechanic, and he was married to a woman 10 years older than himself. The marriage didn't fit the profile, but Brussell followed it through. That was really where it was close, but Brussell knew once he found out he was married, wasn't him.
Mm-hmm.
They had so many false leads on this. But during this time, the bomber gets aggravated. He steps up his attacks and writes more letters. He also called Dr. Brussell directly a feat of cleverness. He also called Dr. Brussell directly a feat of cleverness in and of itself, since the doctor's number was unlisted. The conversation went as follows.
So he's ringing this guy a phone.
He's calling Dr. Brussell.
Hello. Locking him up, yes.
Ding, ding. Hello.
Hello.
Is this Dr. Brussell, the psychiatrist?
It is.
Yes, this is Dr. Brussell.
This is FP speaking. Keep out of this or you'll be sorry. And then hung up. Now, they couldn't trace the call, but Brussell was pleased. He knew he'd gotten under his skin. Now, meanwhile, Con Edison assigned several of its administrative staff members to go through all the troublesome employee files, much like we have here. For anyone who might fit the complex or fit this profile,
why didn't you do that in 1940? I mean,
you would have thought. but this was just a they had different filings. It was a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I guess you know it was all on paper files. It wasn't
on
databases.
And remember, Con Ed owned a bunch of other companies.
Right. And this was, because he worked for a subsidiary of Con Ed. He didn't work for Con Ed directly, so.
Right. Now, a clerk named Alice Kelly, she went through stacks of files, and she came up on a file for George Matetsky of Waterbury, Connecticut. He'd worked for Union Electric and Power Company. He fit the profile, so Kelly took a closer look. Metesky had suffered an on-the-site accident at the plant where he worked. He blamed his subsequent consumption on that accident, a claim that could not be proven. After his disability claim was denied, Metesky had written several angry letters to the company, one promising revenge
for the firm's dastardly deeds.
Ooh. Did he sign it FP?
No, that was just in his file.
All right, okay.
She excitedly brought the file to her supervisor. Her supervisor had been having an affair with her we'll get on to that part of the story later. I think maybe, she said as she handed over the file. Well, meanwhile, they got a lead there. So meanwhile, the bomber, he's just taunting the media and police.
Mm-hmm.
In response to an open letter in the journal American, Obama gave the details, including dates and places, of the accident that had injured him. In doing so, he made the kind of arrogant slip-up that Dr. Brussell had predicted he would. Obama assumed the records of the accident and claims were long lost in the files of the in those files. He didn't know that Alice Kelly, who was sleeping with her supervisor.
No, she wasn't. Don't defame Miss Kelly.
Nah, she long dead. We can't defame nobody that's dead.
Yeah.
Back in those days, don't you watch Mad Men?
They all slept with their
secretaries. They all slept with the secretaries. She wouldn't have been working so hard if she wasn't sleeping with the guy and getting some jewelry and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like coats. A very dedicated employee. She's going through all those files and pull out, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack.
Well, she found it. And the dates matched the one that Metesky had given to the newspaper. Now, neighbors, George Metesky, the neighbors didn't know what to make of him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a dapper. He was a Slav.
Mm-hmm. A dapper Slav.
A dapper Slav.
He said a Slav.
A Slavic man who lived at on number 17 4th Street in Waterbury. His two unmarried sisters. He didn't appear to work for a living. He was always polite. He was distant. Nobody in the neighborhood knew anything about him. Local children feared him and called his house the crazy house, despite there being or no evidence of madness. Little kids know.
Yeah.
Little kids know.
Pretty good at diagnosing.
He attended St. Patrick's Church, but that didn't, and he made a lot of other trips, but people wondered where he went. And still others wondered what he made in his workshop at all hours of the day or night.
Busy for a man with no job.
Yeah. Now, around the same time as the newspapers began to publicize Dr. Brussell's profile of the mad bomber, the neighbors noticed a change in Metesky. He seemed friendlier and even talkative at times. Helped the local boy fix his model airplane. And the neighborhood children were no longer afraid of him.
He was getting the attention that he wanted.
Yeah, people in the neighborhood remarked to one another that maybe they had misjudged his crazy ass.
No.
Had they known that George Metesky had once worked for Con Edison, they might have made the connection between him and Obama. They might have been suspicious as the police stopped by number 17 on a routine house-to-house check regarding an automobile accident and did not stop at any other houses.
So house check only went to one house.
Yeah, just went to one house. Now, a few nights later, the neighbors were shocked when police came and arrested Metesky. Dressed in his bathroom, he pleasantly and politely confessed to being the bomber. He revealed that FP stood for
Fair Play.
Fair Play.
That's all he wanted, Fair Play.
Police requested that Metesky put on some clothes, and he obliged.
What did he put on, Colonel?
He put on a double-breasted suit, buttoned up, Timmy.
So the profile were pretty accurate.
It was very accurate. Now, this was a huge, huge, huge feather in Finney's cap. He continued his stellar career and later became a well-known corruption buster, Timmy.
Very good.
This case catapulted Dr. Brussell to fame. He was often called in as a consultant on one of the nation's most nation's most troubling unsolved cases. He had different degrees of success. He did the Wiley murders, which we could do sometime.
Mm-hmm. Is that Wiley Coyote?
This was a different one.
Okay.
Wiley Coyote actually never murdered anybody. He had a lot of plans for it.
He had a lot of assault.
A lot of attempted aggravated murder.
Yeah, his problem was he always got his material, bomb-making material from Acme.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, give him a bad name.
He really need to go to a different company after a while.
He did the Sunday Bomber, and most notably the case of Boston Strangler, which day we're going to have to do, because you know this man, I joke about this, but you know this man, Albert DeSalvo?
Yeah.
He would masturbate 10 times a day.
Yeah, I'm not sure he was guilty. I think there's some doubt with it.
There's some doubt as to whether he's guilty, but he, by his own admission, masturbated 10 times a day.
That's just bragging.
He's just bragging. I mean, you get blisters and calluses at some point.
Yeah.
But his work changed the way police catch criminals.
Go through a lot of tissue paper, too.
tube socks.
Sock, yeah.
Yeah, who left that tube sock under here again? Standing up by itself, for Christ's sake.
Step right into it.
Now, George Metesky, who fit the profile in every detail, was found insane and committed to the asylum for the criminally insane. As is the case with most acute paranoids, he was unresponsive to treatment, believing psychiatrists were part of the conspiracy against him. He proved to be a model patient and spent much of his time trying to blow up the hospital.
That's not true.
Trying to legally win his release.
And they were confounded when they found letters from FP. Yeah. Caught in a profile. Figuring out who's bombing the men's room at the mental hospital.
So Dr. Brussel used to visit him occasionally. Brussel always found him talkative and charming. Metesky often pointed out that he purposefully constructed his bombs not to kill anyone. Brussel once asked him directly if he thought he was crazy. Metesky smiled politely and said, nope. So Metesky's actions went on to inspire new criminals. Investigators believed that both the Unabomber and the Zodiac Killer took inspiration from the Mad Bomber by writing to the newspapers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Upon his release from the crazy place, Metesky took up residence in his family's house. He died in 1994 at the age of 90s. His death did not even make the newspapers, Timmy. Mm.
And if you see pictures of him, like I said, his effect is really strange. He's always got this bright smile on his face. Mm-hmm. And he was loving the attention. And, he probably did make the bomb so it won't hurt people. I mean, because you would think out of 33 bombs, you would kill somebody.
Unless he was a really poor mad bomber. Unless he was just a little aggravated bomber. He wasn't a mad bomber. Right. I mean, he was a little pissed off at
him. Yeah, but he put him in places where there was a lot of foot traffic, so yeah, who knows. So, Colonel, where can people find us?
Well, Timmy, now we're not done here, Timmy.
We're going to wrap this
thing up. We have done this thing under protest. And okay. What I'm going to do, Timmy, is I'm going to create a profile.
Okay.
Just like our doctor here did. Of Rutabaga.
Okay.
Okay.
Like Dr. Brussels did. Rudy wear a double-breasted suit?
Rudy
does wear clothes, because I've seen him in clothes.
Rudy just wears a Broncos and a Reds jersey.
Okay.
I'm gonna put together a profile of the Rutabaga.
Okay.
And I think our listeners, I'm gonna apologize to you now because you've been cheated. I mean, we could have had a long story about the Rutabaga and his many daring feats and bravery. I mean, who's the guy we did on World War I that killed all the Germans? He's the Alvin York of dogs,
Alvin
Rudy.
York, yeah.
Rudy is.
Okay, and, we'll talk about him in a future podcast.
So he's been cheated, and listeners, your voices, they've been dismissed.
Yeah.
They've been dismissed.
They've been disfranchised. Colonel, where can people find us?
Well, you know, the best place to find us is on iTunes. Find us on iTunes. Leave us a review. Tell us what you think. You can also find us two places on Facebook. You can find us on the History Dweebs page. Mm-hmm. Now, if you like to talk and you like to get involved in conversations, the History Dweebs podcast page.
Yeah, just ask. It's a group.
It's a group. Just ask to join. We let anybody in. Yeah. We let Scotty J in, so we let anybody in. We let some of those Team Brandy people in.
Yes, we let them all. Anyone that wants to join, we're happy to have you. So just send us. Just look us up, History Dweebs. The podcast on Facebook group.
And you can find us on Libsyn, but I don't know if anybody really uses that.
You know what? We only get about 10%. No, we only get about 20% of our listeners on iTunes. Most of them are from our Facebook page.
Are they?
Which is cool. We love that you listen to us wherever, but we'd love to build up. If you have a choice, listen to us from iTunes, because then we can begin in that, you know, build our numbers on iTunes up a little bit. But we have tons of listeners, and we'd probably be in the top 100 if we, I don't know, I don't know how many you need to be in the top 100, but I think we would, if all of our downloads came from iTunes, we would be, higher on their list, but, we don't care. Wherever you listen to us is fine, but
wherever you listen, just listen.
Yeah, we're just glad you're listening.
So that's where you can find us. You can find us on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. At HistoryDweebs1.
Do we tweet much?
We do. We tweet out. We don't tweet much, but we tweet every episode. And, I tweet some.
Colonel doesn't have a Twitter. The Colonel uses Twitter now and again.
Yeah, well, you need to tweet more. Elise is demanding that we do Sam Cooke. We will try to get to Sam Cooke sometime. We'll try to do him coming up. Anyway, let's wrap this up. We got to get out of here. Colonel, any final thoughts?
No, I just think he was a poor bomber for, you know, he was a peaked bomber. He was a little.
I think it was attention getting and a little odd man.
Look at his pictures.
We'll put his pictures on both pages. We'll post them.
And we also need to go to the History Dweebs Facebook or the podcast page. You will see we have an added bonus for our listeners. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of Rutabaga as a puppy.
Yeah, I saw
on
that
the page.
Yes.
So
Rudy's getting his props.
Yeah, he gets them. So that's where you can find us. And listeners, if you feel a little bit cleaner, you feel a little happier, you feel a little bit more joy in your hearts, you feel more righteous. Well, it's because the devil wasn't here.
Oh yeah, that's true.
That's why.
She'll be back. Yeah,
she'll be back.
Her evil presence will be back.
Well, it's Easter. You know what? It's Easter. You know what happens a week after Easter?
What's that?
The devil has risen.
The devil
has risen.
Yeah. So. Zombie Brandy will be joining us.
Yes.
In a couple more days. So, anyway, thank you for joining us, and we'll see y'all again next time on History.
Have a good day, listeners.
Bye bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.